Hello and welcome to the Walt Weekly Podcast with your host, Walter Latham Sr. and co-host, Michelle Sweeney McCombs. Today's guest, we have Tambra Ray Stevenson from Washington, D.C. and Abuja, Nigeria. She is the founder and CEO of WANDA, Women Advancing Nutrition, Dietetics, and Agriculture, inspiring a new generation of food heroes from Africa to the diaspora. 2021 Science Defender by Union of Concerned Scientists, 2021 Changemaker by Clean Eating Magazine, and 2020 Changemaker by Washington City Paper. Please welcome Ms. Tambra Ray Stevenson to the Walt Weekly.
All right, now the last time that we were, when we were doing pre-production, we were talking about the fact that on September 28th, you were going down to Washington, D.C., and you were making the second ever White House conference with, along with the NAACP, on hunger, nutrition, health, since the Nixon administration. So this is the second one since the Nixon administration?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So how did that go? I understand from what I've read, y'all guy had to do a presentation to a representative of the White House or the FDA. I mean, how did that turn out?
Well, for many people, they were really not sure all the details with this conference since it was only announced on May 4th of this year. And over that time period, listening sessions were being convened across the country by the White House as well as other organizations, ours included, WANDA, which is Women Advancing Nutrition, Dietetics, and Agriculture. And it led up into the unveiling of a national strategy by the Biden administration just a day prior to the actual full-day convening of the Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health that was here in Washington, D.C., that really gathered around 600 or so leaders in the country, everyone from the CEO of the Chobani Company to James Burke Foundation to Dr. Dean Ornish, Dr. Mark Hyman, as well as congressional members such as Booker and McGovern, who were some of the key congressional members that helped to put the legislation forth to help authorize and fund this conference, which was about a little bit more than $1 million allocated to support this effort. And so the full-day conference opened up with one, the USDA Secretary Vilsack speaking around the reason why we are convening. And also there was another African-American woman who comes from Houston by way of Oakland, California, that told her personal lived experience around hunger and developing her own organization to help convene and address these inequities in her own community. And then she made an introduction of President Biden, who talked about the national strategy and one of the key components, which was around making sure that every American does not go hungry and have an ambitious goal of by 2030 to have really a whole society approach, meaning key government agencies as well as industry and philanthropic organizations coming together to collaborate to really address critical issues around the five pillars that, you know, address everything from nutrition security, food as medicine, as well as supporting more equitable nutrition research and the like.
So those are the five pillars?
Those were some of the highlights of the five pillars. People can go to health.gov to learn more of the pillars. They were covered in the listening sessions and obviously in the national strategy that people can find that report online as well. And so throughout the day, there were sessions from basically 9 to 5 that allowed people to go and listen to panel speakers who are either entrepreneurs working on healthy food access, to researchers at universities who study this issue, as well as to government officials who are also administrating these programs, such as FNEP, SNAP, WIC, that are helping to provide support to everyday low-income families.
That's amazing. Okay. That's amazing. I have a quick question in reference to what you just said. You know, it's amazing to me that it's been since the Nixon candidacy that anyone has addressed this. Now they're given a date of 2030. That's a long time for something that's been going on for so many years. Why? I don't understand why they can't figure this out.
Yeah, honestly, we were contacted around, you know, those commitments, what can be done sooner within the next 1 to 2 years. And so the commitments that organizations have made that helped to address these critical issues were also unveiled that day of the conference as well, which collectively is more than $8 billion efforts from organizations, even from my home state of Oklahoma, and how organizations outside of government can make an impact on this issue. And so, yes, the context in which this conference is happening is the fact that, one, we are in the midst of the UN Decade of Action on Nutrition. And so this issue about attacking these nutrition security issues have been underway for a very long time. The UN Food Systems Summit of 2021 was also a critical kind of catalytic converter to really have the next stage of other countries saying, what are you doing in your respective countries to attack this issue? Earlier this June, the United Kingdom released their own national strategy. Some critics called it feeble in its attempt to not really address the universal school meals program as much as the U.S. has also pushed forward, Biden, that issue that we need to ensure that after this pandemic, that when nutrition security really became very prominent as another pandemic, that we need to make sure that our children are being fed so they can have better academic performance and understand how we can have more productive Americans in this country. And so it's really the U.S. as well as other countries that are having to touch this issue and find solutions. And so this was that attempt to do so. Back in 1969, more than 1,800 recommendations were made. And those recommendations were unveiled post this conference. And so we anticipate something very similar in terms of looking within the next 6 months, what will be the next phase post this White House conference of seeing real actionable, measurable steps being announced and taken by the collective government and non-government entities on this issue.
Great.
Yep.
Okay, so you do have actionable items, right? Just to reiterate for clarity. Okay, all right, then the next steps, I mean, when we spoke, you were, you know, a little bit apprehensive as to what you were going to achieve. So would you say that you have achieved? There's an achievement. 2030 is a date. I guess that's a hard date because you have it in your meeting minutes or whatever notes that you kept. So would you consider that a success?
Well, 2030 is the timeline that the U.S. government has put forth this administration of looking to eradicate hunger in America. However, there are more immediate short-term goals that have been laid out that have been published within the national strategy. And that national strategy, gee, I just want to reiterate, is based on a combination of reports that were submitted over the summer, our organization included, to really help inform some of the key issues that feed into the need to address food and nutrition security. And what that also means is within our focus of food and nutrition security is one is the hunger piece. Hunger is really more than just the malnutrition that we recall in 1969, but it's also represents the double burden of malnutrition, which we see in the form of metabolic health issues like obesity, that a person can have obesity and also still be malnourished from a protein energy deficit perspective that we see in our communities that are facing food apartheid. And so it's not simply just looking at eradicating food apartheid in the form of adding more grocery stores, but also the need to diversify the nutrition professional workforce to make sure that we have communities having access to providers that can provide that credible cultural nutrition information. And then also ensuring that our research speaks to the changing times of making sure that the dietary guidelines that are being put forth and used by health professionals, that it's also speaking to the changing demographics and cultural food considerations that have not always been the case. And so an example, a great book that came out just this year is Eating While Black, about food and race shaming in America by Psyche Williams-Forson, that she is a university professor at University of Maryland, and in it speaking to this issue around how Black food culture has been weaponized and demonized and how that shows up even in our policies. And I think that's a critical conversation to be had, because when we look at economic opportunities for Black communities, especially Black women who are food entrepreneurs, if they are not receiving the technical support, the access to capital to really be a part of this initiative around nutrition security, that is a really missed opportunity when it comes to human capital investment to ensure that we make sure that our communities are part of the solution and not simply just the beneficiaries of programs that are operated by people outside of our own communities. So that is why this idea of ensuring community and our lived experiences are a part of this conversation and also part of the action plan when it comes to this national strategy.
Okay. Okay. Do y'all guys have milestones that you're going to be monitoring this up until 2030? That's number one. Second thing, the Food Bill of Rights, is that legislated? I mean, somebody writing some legislation?
Currently, it is not in a legislative form. It is a conceptual framework that has been put forth in the public sphere to have a discourse around what does it mean to have a Food Bill of Rights. Most recently, the White House has put forth an AI Bill of Rights around automated systems where algorithm discrimination can happen. When we think about facial recognition with basically cameras operated by police departments. And so it's like, if we can make a Bill of Rights around understanding what the democratic rights should look like in protecting people from technology that can be weaponized, well, why not develop a similar Bill of Rights when it comes to food, which can also be weaponized? And we see this in the form of, you know, ultra-refined processed foods that really dominate in our communities that are lacking grocery store access of healthy foods and community gardens and nutrition education and so forth. And so we had a representative, Mary Blackford, who is the owner of Market 7 based out of Washington, D.C., building the first Black woman-owned food hall in Ward 7 that is a community also riddled by food apartheid, and sharing on the stage in support of the Food Bill of Rights, sharing to the public around the importance of the need to adopt. And so we will continue to beat the drum, because the idea of a Food Bill of Rights does come from a collective grassroots agency, which is critical when we think about the key component of democracy, which is the full participation of citizens of helping to form and make a perfect union in this country. And as April Ryan's book, who she is a White House correspondent, talks about in her anthem about Black women having to save the world, especially this past administration, that we are continuing to do that, show up and show out in the form of seeing food also as extension of that democratic right, that we have to be in that industry that is, you know, a $1 trillion industry that everyone relies on, and that we have not been full participations, but we know our ancestors helped to build this food system. And so we should not only be the beneficiaries, but also the producers in receiving the reparations, which is another critical part of the conversation of what can that be in the form of. And so in many ways, you know, the Food Bill of Rights, which we speak about, the declaration is really about helping to inform the future of food and nutrition policy in this country by having a core set of values that help unify us and not divide us.
Okay. Michelle, you have any questions?
That's hard to follow. She's very detail-oriented, bro. This is great. So, you know, this I love the good. Fact that you included that, you know, the food came, you know, it originated from us, and, you know, reparations with it as well. So this is a phenomenal thing that you're doing. And I think it's going to be a big thing. And hopefully it won't take that long, 2030, to make this very successful.
Yeah, I mean, I think the momentum that we saw around Black Lives Matter after George Floyd really sparked the dynamic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was saying our argument is if Black Lives Matter, then our Black health matters, our Black food matters, and that if yes. people want to support this Food Bill of Rights, that they should go to iamwanda.org/Food Bill of Rights. We also released a state of food democracy survey, which we have close to 1,000 responses that is still open and available for others to participate. And again, that link is also available on the petition site along with the Food Bill of Rights that really is the first of its kind to assess and examine and better understand how people show up and really their political action around food. And that can be everything from signing petitions to holding right. issue candidate forums with this upcoming midterm election, as well as making yes. sure that they are represented on local food policy councils that are all mechanisms to create the change in our local respective communities.
Amazing. All right, fantastic. Well, you have a term, food sheroes. Could you define what a food shero would look like or what they would do?
Most definitely. We know these women, they're in our own families. They are our mothers, our aunties, our grandmothers, our sisters, who in essence have been really the cultural keepers, the culinary creators, and really the meal healers in our family that go before even slavery, but back to the motherland, who understood mm-hmm. the power of food and the healing power that it represents, that it's ritual, that it's identity, it's culture, it is our medicine, and that over time through really colonization, we have lost in many ways that deep-rooted spiritual connection to what food represents. And so the work of Wanda really is about encouraging everyday women to see themselves as food sheroes, as they showed up as lunch ladies during the pandemic in their homes when their children had to be at home and learn, or having to be the caregiver for the elder in their families, and really be there as sister friends for those who don't have families. And it's for us, we say, we need to unlock that food shero in all of us that are able to rise up and not only be the change within our own personal lives and families, but also for our communities. And so that looks like that person like a Mary Blackford that is opening up a food hall in our communities, providing greater, healthier access and an opportunity for Black entrepreneurs to increase their livelihood. That looks like those who are serving on the local food policy councils that are advocating tirelessly for communities that have went with no voice in larger structural systems. And that looks like those who are just simply making better, healthy meals for their families with the recipes that they've been remixed from their own families and capturing that and sharing that almost as an archival representative of how they've used their family recipes to survive. I mean, it literally can start from the very basic levels of what it means to help heal our communities and ourselves.
Right.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah, Michelle?
No, I was going to say correct, because, you know, a lot of this generation, they don't cook anymore. They don't have the big mamas. I mean, my generation, I cook, you know, everything is takeout, Chinese food, you know, very unhealthy eating. And it does come from home. Mm-hmm. Comes from home. So exactly. That's fantastic.
And I would say part of our work taking an intersectional lens with a focus of Black women in the food system is that throughout my academic training in nutrition and health, it was very uncommon to hear about stories of a Georgia Gilmore or a Fannie Lou Hamer or a Harriet Tubman and the role that they played within food and health. I mean, many people may not know that Harriet Tubman was a nurse and a cook. I mean, her mom taught her how to cook, and that helped her to fund her work in helping to liberate our people. And same with Georgia Gilmore, who had an underground cooking club, which other women who basically helped to feed the revolution when it came to the civil rights movement in Alabama, that really jeopardized her own life, but she knew that the greater cause was bigger than her. And so this idea of finding deeper meaning and purpose in the food system and how food can be this liberatory tool that can really lead us to this other next wave of what the promised land can look like is really the ultimate goal of all of this work, that we have been in many ways seen examples from Black Panthers who have understood what it represents, that if you have a hungry society, they cannot fully operate in a democratic way of advocating for themselves. And so it's really about understanding that when we have properly fed societies and communities and children is when we can begin to create that society that really everyone rises up together. And so a well-nourished nation is a more secure nation. And that's the critical reason why we're calling for nutrition security as an extension of national security, that right now we have troops being sent off to war who cannot because they are not fit to fight. And so you have four-star generals who are speaking out on childhood obesity because they literally don't have the platoons and troops that are able to secure the country when it comes to times of war. And so we have our own war inside of this country.
Right.
And that is the war around, you know, this ability to like make this connection between our food being our medicine and our cultural food in particular.
So it's in our natural interest to, you know, to make sure that we eat the right foods and what you are advocating. You know, if not implemented, then we're not war ready, because there'd be too many fat people or people with diseases like diabetes and high blood pressure for us to effectively wage a war.
Right.
So it's a national security issue also, isn't it?
Oh, I mean, very much so. I was a born national security education scholar, and one of the key reasons why I, you know, went abroad to study was seeing how public health is an extension of national security. You know, I went to Dominican Republic to understand their food and health systems. And by going through that experience, it reaffirmed this idea that we are one interdependent when it comes to our global food supply. We see what is happening in Ukraine with a global food crisis how it has an indirect relationship to the U.S. Because we have not focused on building stronger, resilient, sustainable local and regional food systems, which the pandemic really helped to highlight. And so in order to have a more secure country, we also have to look at building better local regional food systems. And so you see the alternative food movements to the cooperatives, to the community gardens, to the urban ag centers that are being cultivated, and the call for more funding support through USDA with the regional food business centers being established with funding this year, and so much congressional allocated funding that is helping to both address the nutrition education aspect as well as the food business opportunities within the system. And so I hope, you know, organizations in our communities really take advantage of the funding. Many of the funding will go to land-grant institutions like my own Oklahoma State University, because for many who don't know about land-grant institutions, these institutions came about post-Civil War in ensuring that we have states that are able to get people to work, working on the farm, helping to support the agriculture economy in this country. And so Extension Services came from that, which is ensuring that we're not only educating, doing the research, but also being service to the community. So as a product of a land grant who's worked in cooperative extension where ag and nutrition services are available, we have them at HBCUs, about 19 of them, including Tuskegee and others, where they're doing research on a variety of crops and educating our low-income families. They are a critical aspect of this nutrition security plan that we need to uplift and highlight and also modernize by having an overlay of communication technology. Because, again, when nutrition education had been deployed, it mostly had been in person prior to the pandemic, and the pandemic exposed the need to leverage technology. As we saw, a lot of folks were on Zoom, a lot of people were on social media, and so these are other communication technologies that have to be utilized to reach the masses and provide more credible health nutrition information and combating those who are spreading disinformation in this country, especially when it comes to misinforming our communities that are already lacking critical resources to begin with. And so being able to build those relationships with our universities as much as our community and nonprofit organizations, and working with media organizations like yours is so important to get the word out to the community, because Black media, even at the time of the high racial tensions in the early 1900s, operated not only as just information sources, but as social justice advocates for the community. And so they also play a critical role in this work as well. So thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, we're learning a lot. The audience, primarily the audience, is learning a lot, and that's what we care about. That's top, and, you know, that's the top, you know, in terms of our priority and our mission and our mandate. Before I go any further, I just want to just talk about you graduated from Oklahoma State, right? Is that the HBCU? I know you may have said it, but
Oklahoma
let me just.
It's an 1890 land grant institution, so it's a predominantly white institution that is based in Stillwater, Oklahoma. And I went there to get a degree in human nutritional sciences and a minor in Spanish. And so it really provided the background in terms of doing nutrition research, botany research, and really valuing research as the backbone of clinicians, and it providing evidence-based policies that we need. And so one of the key pieces for us was to be able to plant that seed as someone who was the only African-American in my nutrition program at the time. And it was clear to me that we need to diversify our field. We need more Black folks in agriculture, in nutrition. And so one of the key initiatives that we put forth with our Food Shiro Freedom Fund was working with corporations, entities that really want to help address the lack of diversity in the field by setting up Wanda Endowed Scholarships. And so we were able to do that this past year and received the first recipient, who is a young Black woman from Oklahoma who's majoring in nutrition. And the idea with this endowment is that every year a $1,000 scholarship will be issued to a student, whether they're majoring in agriculture, nutrition, or dietetics, or a food-related discipline. And we want to be able to replicate that at other universities to ensure that when we think about this student loan debt crisis, that we are helping to alleviate the financial burden and hardship that many of our communities are facing as first-generation college students, as I was, and those who really want to make an impact in a profession that not only gives back to themselves, but also to society.
Now, I'm just guessing, okay? Mm-hmm. I know you got some student loans outstanding, so are you waiting for Biden to try to forgive some of them? Well, I think he's going to do it partially.
Yeah.
Some of those student loans?
I definitely will look to have the financial support through the student loan debt relief program, which is this year, that was announced, and also needing to meet that deadline. And honestly, you know, I was really good at securing academic scholarships through my undergrad degree, through my graduate degree. I was able to pay off part of the loan, well, all of the loans of my graduate degree with my first job.
Okay, good.
Health and Human Services. But when I went back to do dietetics and take the dietetic internship, for the most part, is a non-paid one-year program that's required to sit for the registered dietitian exam. That is the financial burden that many people cannot afford. And so that is how I came about with additional student loan debt, which is why I'm so much an advocate of the need to help provide funding support for students who are choosing to go down that route in terms of becoming a registered dietitian.
Okay. You went to Tufts also, right?
Yes, I did. After Oklahoma State, I went to Tufts University, the School of Medicine, where I received my master's in public health, focusing on health communication. And it, at the time, was rated number one in community health by U.S. News and housed within the Family Medicine and Community Health Department. And it was a great experience because, unlike universities that may be research focused, we were very much community based for focus. So working with community based organizations like Boston Black Women's Health Institute, working with Black owned PR firms, as well as CBS Health Watch and other ad agencies, to understand the importance of leveraging media marketing advertisement to help inform communities around critical health issues and provide them with the resources that they can use to change their behavior and also improve their life. And so I am very much a beneficiary of that program, and now to be in coming back in the form of serving on our Tufts Friedman School Food and Nutrition Innovation Council as a representative of WANDA, which that new institute helps to bring industry and university together to provide research opportunities for students, as well as really informing how can industry change to really factor in nutrition security, as the co-chair for nutrition security and other issues like precision nutrition and food as medicine and sustainable nutrition are the other working groups that have been outlined and that we meet on a twice a year in Boston to come together to issue new reports and come up with new policy frameworks that can inform the field and profession.
Thank you. Yeah, Wanda, I want to circle back to Oklahoma State and your initiative, Wanda's Scholarship Fund. Are you doing that in conjunction with Oklahoma State, or?
Yes, that scholarship is being fully administered by the OSU Foundation.
Excellent.
Any student that is eligible will be automatically considered in the scholarship program, and a scholarship committee is established to screen and identify candidates who will be acknowledged, and we receive a biography of a student every year that has received the scholarship.
Okay. I know that in our show description, we're going to have a lot of information and links to your website where they can find a lot more information on these scholarship funds, right?
Yeah, people can go to iamwanda.org/fund to support our initiatives that range from the scholarship fund, which is huge for us. The goal is always to raise at minimum $26,000 a year to help support that those scholarships being implemented at different universities. And then there are lower amounts that can be given to support our other initiatives that range from our Sisterhood Supper, which provides really the convening of Black women and honoring and celebrating those who are local food heroes in our communities. And so we've been doing that for the past 2 years for Juneteenth. But also we have our Wanda Academy, as well as our Wanda books that we create to really help children to see themselves as food heroes with our little character, Little Wanda, in the community that we go, at least prior to the pandemic, we're traveling to Africa, to Nigeria, to Ethiopia, and making books available in local African languages so children can see themselves and their food culture into the process of really healing their families and their communities.
Tremendous, tremendous. And you would consider your organization global, am I correct?
Yeah, we are a silo smasher. We cut through local, global, generationally, and sector. And so being a silo smasher for us is understanding that that is how you remain innovative, by not trapping yourself in a box. And so in terms of global, what we have in terms of our representation is being able to show up and really help even facilitate high-level meetings and convenings, such as the World Bank Spring Meetings. Next week, we will be at the World Food Prize Foundation Borlaug Dialogues on panels to talk about the need to address food and climate change together. With COP27 happening in Egypt next month, November, you have this call for seeing at the nexus food sustainability and health, that new policies and initiatives really need to come together on that. And that's what this Food Bill of Rights also does, is making these connections and seeing the intersectionality of sectors that really have a lot of overlap that need to be addressed together. And so we're looking forward to engaging with other colleagues and helping to, again, shape the discourse and hopefully influence those who are implementing programs, doing the research, working in industry about how to rethink how we are no longer in silos when we think about our food system, our health system, and our ecosystem, that we all have to see the need to converge and convene together.
Okay. Okay. Michelle?
That's awesome. No, thank you so much, Tamsa. We appreciate all this information that you're providing to the communities and putting it on the Walt Weekly platform to help you.
Thank you.
Yeah, our listeners will definitely enjoy this. I mean, it's a learning. Everything we try to do is to make sure that we're providing an opportunity for our listeners to learn something, you know, or to reiterate something that's already out there that they may know that they're not leveraging.
And make change, too, and make it change as well, right? That's the goal. I mean, like you said earlier, Tamba, the Black Panthers, I know that was a huge part of their organization, feeding the community healthier. So hopefully, well, I know this will be successful for you, that's for sure. You're on the right steps with this. And progress in your past history of doing this is definitely going to be a big impact in many communities.
Thank you very much.
Oh yeah, I'm very proud of you. I'm very, very proud of you. Would you consider yourself a millennial or younger? You are a millennial. Ah, okay. You shouldn't have said. You should not have said that, Tamba, because we have a millennial series where we try to highlight the accomplishments of the millennials. We've done two. You may want to check it out. We've done two, right, Michelle?
Yeah, this is three now.
But we didn't do it yet.
You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at The Walt Weekly, Twitter at Walt Weekly, Podbean, The Walt Weekly, and www.thewaltweekly.com. www.thewaltweekly.com. You can also find us on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Pandora, and other streaming platforms.